Emmy Award-winning sportscaster Brian Kenny wants to reshape the way we think about baseball. In his new book, Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution, Kenny, the outspoken MLB Network host and commentator, explains how baseball has been revolutionized after decades of resistance by analytical thinking. Digging deep into baseball history, Kenny shares engaging stories and anecdotes from players past and present and those who have reshaped the game. Again, the name of the book is Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Brian Kenny to the roundtable this morning. Brian, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What brought you to want to look at this revolution?
I've been involved in it, in covering baseball and in the media for a few decades now, for 25 years, and I've seen it unfold from what turns out to be a unique vantage point in the mainstream media, and being someone that was able to read a lot of this early sabermetric stuff that was out there and kind of be able to put it out there in the media and then see it rejected by both the baseball establishment and by the mainstream media itself. And that has always puzzled me. And when I found myself fighting the same fights after I went to MLB Network, I really started to look at, why is this? Why does the culture reject this information?
So when it comes to the information itself, when did you start to accept it and understand it? Was it a slow process for you, or did you instantly embrace it?
No, it was a process. I was reading Total Baseball in 1991, which was a baseball encyclopedia, and John Thorne and Pete Palmer had put that together. And they had a chapter in there that they excerpted from The Hidden Game of Baseball, which was in 1984. I was reading that then, started reading Bill James in the 90s, and it was all in front of me, but I didn't really become strident about it until I was doing baseball mainly every single day for Baseball Tonight on ESPN. And as, you know, when you're a TV guy and you're doing the highlights on TV for baseball game after game after game, you're always looking for things to put it into context, that this guy leads the league in RBIs, or this guy is a two-time batting champion, or this guy is, he might be the MVP this year. You're always throwing those things out there. So as I was studying the game closely, I was, you know, more immersed in it, and I realized, why am I saying these old things when they're not the best tools to use to measure players? And I started using those, the best available tools that were available and that were out there and had been out there for a while. And that somehow, you know, turned me into something very different. People were stunned to hear, why are you talking about on base and slugging? And, you know, what do you mean ERA is no good and all these things? What do you mean pitcher wins are misleading? What are you talking about? And that was very much against the grain. Even though that stuff had been out there, there really was nobody else on television that was putting it out there.
You talk about this in the book, but we have these ideas, many of us do, about the tradition of baseball and respecting the game of baseball. And you say a lot of these traditions go back to the 19th century, and I guess there's a place for them, but it is also time, in your opinion, to move on from them.
Well, it was time to move on in 1920. That's the amazing thing. It was time to, as soon as the live ball came into play, and this is a fascinating thing, I think, about our own nature. If the founding fathers had been able to live another, you know, 30 years, the, you know, talking about Henry Chadwick and the guys of the 1880s and 1890s who were forming this game, they were very flexible in their thinking. But once they laid things out, like, you know, batting average, not slugging percentage, you know, there were all sorts of ways to try to quantify, you know, production, you know, in life and in baseball. And once they laid down these dead ball rules, everyone just kind of accepted them and were loath to move from them as if they were, you know, set in stone. And I don't know why that was, but as I studied and went through the book, I realized it is part of our nature to hold on very tight to the information we learn as children. There's something in our evolutionary nature that causes us to cling to things that probably ensured our survival. And that goes all the way through to the numbers on the back of our baseball cards when we were children. That's why I found myself in various situations, and maybe you do as well, when you say you're at a seminar or you're listening to a new boss or a new way of thinking, people don't just say, I'm not sure about that. People get angry. I mean, they actually fight against it.
Right.
And I've found in baseball, ex-players, people on TV, they will fight you on this. They get angry. They don't want to hear you. They say, look, like, I hear you, but I don't want to talk about this anymore. And I was always stunned by that.
And that's one of the things that you point out, that this is a war on several fronts, but really we can look at, especially amongst fans, and then, of course, players and people within the game itself. And have you found one to be more inviting to these concepts than other?
Well, the baseball industry itself has now accepted it. And once the baseball industry itself, fully embraced this, and the fans, the younger fans especially, who were raised on the internet and have trained themselves to look things up and not just take an expert's point of view as gospel, once those two things were happening, the mainstream media has no choice but to go with it. The funny thing is, you would think that the media would reflect what is happening in the industry, but many in the mainstream media actively opposed the changes that were happening in baseball, even as teams were building analytics departments and were hiring people with, titles like Director of Decision Sciences. They openly mocked it. It was kind of like a new age junior high school where you made fun of the smart kids, yet there they were doing it, and that was the world I was living in.
So let's get to some of the things that you talk about in the book. You say it is important for us to forget starting pitchers.
I don't think if we started baseball right now, there's no way we would have something called the starting pitcher. We'd have pitchers. We'd bring them in at different times during the game. But, you have a staff now. Most major league teams have 12 or 13 pitchers actively on their roster, and they have another 6 or 7 or 10 down in AAA, and they'll use between 20 and 30 pitchers in a season. So why would you send someone out there to pitch for as long as he can until he's exhausted or until he gives up a bunch of runs? There's no way we would do that now. We do it because that's the way they did it in 1890, because you had one guy who walked out there, pitched, and pitched the whole afternoon. We still base it off that model, even though we've already acknowledged, hey, you need more than one guy. And in fact, the average start now in baseball is about 5 1/3 innings.
So let's go back to 1890, because you also talk about us worried about errors, and that's something you say we should just ignore.
Yeah, errors are nonsense at this point. And again, like all these other things I'm pointing out, they once did make sense. In the 19th century, guys didn't have gloves. The fields were basically a cow pasture, and hitters were hitting this little mush ball on the ground. So it was very difficult to handle the ball. That was the action in baseball. The action in baseball was the ball is in play. Pretend you're on a schoolyard and you're hitting a Spalding ball around and everybody's running around and racing, and it's fun. It's a fun game. But the ball is bouncing around and it's hard to handle on the ground. At that point, there are 12 errors per game in Major League Baseball. You can imagine how it was in like an industrial league or a youth league. In Major League Baseball, they're making 12 errors a game. So to differentiate between what was an error and what was a base hit or a single, that was very important. That's where the game was. That's why batting average was important, because you weren't hitting that many doubles, triples, or home runs. You didn't have a clean white baseball to hit into an upper deck. In fact, there was no upper deck. You were just hitting the ball on the ground and running. So at the time, 12 errors a game, yeah, errors matter. How many did you make? We made 7. You only made 2. What a great game. What a great defense you have. That mattered. Now, on average, in a major league game, there is 1 error. 1 per 2 teams. And basically, it's usually something that's just obvious. And there are all sorts of other misplays and guys with very little range. And the amount of errors that you are accumulating and keeping track of, it's insignificant defensively as compared to the range of a fielder. We just do it out of habit. Again, a 19th century habit we should just dismiss.
You argue that we should also dismiss bunting.
Well, senseless bunting. As a matter of fact, the Cubs game was on MLB Network, Cubs and Reds, and there's David Ross, a catcher for the Cubs in his late 30s, and the third baseman was standing all the way back. and he bunted it down the line, and he ran it out for a base hit. That's a good bunt. You know, punish the defense. Make them work. But as far as, hey, a leadoff guy is on, let's square to the pitcher. Let everybody know we're bunting. Let everybody know we're not even going to run that hard. We just want to lay this ball down. Please throw me out, and then we'll take our chances with a man on second. That, we've been taught to think, you know, advances our chances of scoring that run because he looks closer. You know, there he is. He's on second. He's closer. What you don't see is that you've, you know, used one-third of your resources, one-third of your outs that inning. That you don't see. That's an abstract. So we all feel good about it, but once you run the numbers, you realize you've not only diminished your chances of scoring multiple runs that inning, you've diminished your chances of scoring one single run that inning. So I'm saying play the percentages, but know the percentages.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book is the team should stop hiring managers based on their looks. Is that a thing? Do people really do that?
Well, listen, not only is that a thing in baseball, that's a thing. I mean, think about it. I'll give you.
Sure.
Well, one, it's a thing. People are hired on what they look like and how they present themselves. It's called representativeness. And with major league managers, I noticed this because there seemed to be one manager after another that was just a big, good-looking guy. And I'm thinking, there can't be that many big, good-looking guys out there, or are they just being hired as managers? So I kind of divvied them up, and I had to apologize to some of the managers that I put in the non-handsome, non-ruggedly handsome category. But it's basically two-thirds of the league is made up of ruggedly handsome managers, guys who fit that archetype because they look the part. Now, a baseball team, you know, is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The decisions your manager is making are worth millions of dollars, especially in the postseason. And yet we have these guys who are ill-equipped to make those decisions. You know, nothing against them, but who are we hiring? We're hiring ex-players who look the part. What about guys who don't look the part? What about women? What about college coaches? That whole talent pool is not even accessed. You know, and I'll give you a quick example. I use this in the book. When I was working at ESPN, I had a producer of mine sitting across from me, and he said to me, as we looked up, and there was these two coordinating producers, basically our bosses, right? These are the bosses that are there. And they're all in our little pods in our newsroom, and there's three or four of them, and they're all arguing loudly. And my producer said to me, hey, do you ever notice that all those guys look the same? And I looked over, and they were all white males, but they were all white males of a certain age. There were also these big, burly alpha male types with these baritone voices. In other words, they looked like they should be bosses. They talked big. They were, oh, blah, blah, blah. You know what, I think they should do this, and yeah, we should do that. Blah, blah, blah. They were just like barking at the top of their lungs. There were these big, you know, alpha dogs in the middle of the room. And we said, hey, do you think they're actually the best people for that job? Or do they just look like they should have that job? And that stuck with me. I thought, they are promoting these same sorts of guys who look like they should be in charge. Now, their job is actually putting together a television program. Putting together a television program, the skills that you need for that have very little to do with your physical size or your voice, or if you can, you know, beat somebody up in a crunch. It has nothing to do with that, and yet that's what we do. So in all aspects of our lives, look around in your own life, realize how often is someone just hired or put into a place by what they look like and what you think the position should look like.
So here we are at the All-Star break. As it stands now, how do you think the season is shaping up?
Well, I think it's been fascinating. The National League has put together these super teams, the Cubs, the Nationals, Giants, and Mets are also quite good. And in the American League, you have this basic parity. You have kind of an upper middle class of teams, and everybody can fight it out. And even the teams that aren't all that good are not far from playoff position. But in the National League, again, we have these teams that have taken their time putting things together. There's also a whole rebuilding class, a JV, if you will, of National League teams that have decided to go the route of the Astros and the Cubs and say, okay, we're not winning this year. Let's bottom out and live to fight another day, maybe in 2 or 3 years. That leads to some inflated win-loss records in the National League and, you know, some exciting teams, some really well put together teams. And probably the story of the season is going to be, you know, can the Cubs stay on top? Can the Cubs compete for the World Series title?
Well, the name of the book is Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution. Brian Kenny, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Again, the name of the book, Ahead of the Curve. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.